Welcome, everybody, to Studio 2, March 21st, a Thursday. I'm Avi Wolf-Manarin.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Forgive me if I laugh. You are so sure of love. You are so young, and I too old to learn of love. That, friends, is the first stanza of Ballad, a poem written by Philadelphia treasurer and renowned poet, playwright, and activist, the Dr. Sonia Sanchez.
Snaps.
Today is World Poetry Day, and so
I'm moved.
I had to give you a little poetry there. So there you go.
Let's transition to something that's not very poetic, but it is very interesting. Our show today.
Yes.
What are we talking about?
We're talking about trash.
Trash?
Yes. We're talking about trash. You know, Philadelphia Mayor Sherelle Parker has made it her top priority, Avi, to clean up the city of Philadelphia. No more will we be called Philadelphia, if Mayor Parker has anything to do with it. We have a full panel of experts with us, including Carlton Williams, director of the Office of Clean and Green Initiatives, your fave trash man, a.k.a. Terrell Hagler, and John McDonald, professor of criminology and sociology at the University of Pennsylvania. And we want to get your comments and questions. Does Philadelphia have a littering culture? What do you think it will take to clean up the city of Philadelphia? You can email us, studio2@whyy.org. You can also call 888-477-9499. And Avi, I know you're really excited about this part, this segment, which is later, is coming up later, right after our news chat. We're going to be talking about Liquid Death.
Liquid Death. I mentioned this brand a week ago on the show because it's valued at over $1 billion.
With a B.
It was started by a local guy, Delaware native Mike Cesario. We're going to talk to him about the meteoric rise of this water brand, Liquid Death. When I talked about Liquid Death on the show last week, Cherry, a listener, very special listener,
yes,
sent me a can because I never tried it before.
Yeah.
Liquid Death. I'm going to open it right here. Okay.
Yeah.
This is sparkling water. Liquid Death is what it sounds like. Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I'm going to take a sip.
Take a sip.
Now I'm ready for the conversation.
Yeah.
Hydrated and ready to go.
Because it murders your thirst.
It murders your thirst.
So we're going to jump into the news. We got a lot coming up on the show, but first the news.
Some news. Okay, so really interesting investigation by The Inquirer that we both enjoyed this morning. You might have noticed more and more businesses in Philadelphia hiring private security. This has been a trend for years, and in fact, they dug up some data in this story that the private security sector in our region is growing quite fast. But perhaps you did not know that in Pennsylvania, unlike many other states, there is very little oversight or training for this entire private security industry. You might not believe this, but it's true. Unarmed guards in this state need zero training mandated.
Mm.
That's less than barbers.
Yeah.
Armed guards need only 40 hours of training before they can start walking the beat, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
So they dive into this in the investigation and look at some of the implications. Something certainly to think about. There was an expert who called the state of play here in Pennsylvania one of the worst in the country.
Yeah, and this has led to, of course, injuries on both sides. You remember that situation at Macy's where a security guard was stabbed. Also, folks have complained of guards being a little aggressive with them. There have been lawsuits against companies because of those interactions with guards. And Avi, I just remember, like, there was a gas station in North Philly where they had hired this armed security and they were walking around with these automatic weapons, sort of trying to deal with this, you know, spike in carjackings in North Philly. And so, you know, I feel like, to my mind, I feel like you should have training in order to have to, you know, more training than just 40 hours. I mean, your barber needs more than 1,200 hours to cut your hair. My hairstylist, more than 1,200 hours. The woman who does my facials need more than 300 hours of training. And you're allowed to hold a weapon with just 40. I feel like there needs to be more done there.
Read the story in The Inquirer and come to your own conclusions, but it is a fascinating investigation. Let's talk about something else that's pretty interesting happening right around the corner from us, potentially, Cherry.
Literally around the corner. Philadelphia's Weizmann National Museum of American Jewish History. It could become part of the Smithsonian Institution. Legislation was introduced in the U.S. Senate by Senator Bob Casey with support from Senator Fetterman, as well as some Republicans. There's also a similar bill in the U.S. House. They're trying to create a commission that would study the possibility of transferring ownership of the museum to the Smithsonian, which is a federal trust, in case you didn't know. The Smithsonian was created back in 1846. It manages 21 museums, 21 libraries. So this is a pretty big deal for Philadelphia's Jewish American History Museum. And while, you know, the Smithsonian mostly operates in Washington, it does have museums in other places as well. So this would be huge. It would ensure the future of the museum. And, you know, they had had some financial issues a few years ago.
Yeah,
so
quite recently,
pretty big deal.
Yeah. And just generally, it does seem like there's some disruption right now in our local museum sector. The Atwater Kent Museum, which was a Philadelphia history based museum, closed several years back. There is this Liberty and Faith Museum that's right across the street from Weitzman that recently announced that it's going to close. So this could provide some security moving forward for the Jewish American History Museum. I'll also point out that the Smithsonian owes us.
Oh.
This is interesting.
Okay. Break it down.
When the Smithsonian was just getting going in the 1800s, they were trying to transition into being a public museum space as opposed to just a teaching institution. And one of the bedrocks of their first collection was stuff that was donated from Philadelphia's Centennial Exposition in 1876, which we talked about last week on the show.
Look at that. Full
circle. Philadelphia helped the Smithsonian get off the ground, and now it may come full circle with the Smithsonian helping Philadelphia.
Yeah, and this would put the Weitzman National Museum of American Jewish History front and center, and, you know, and strengthen our connection with the Smithsonian. So I think that's a wonderful thing. And moving on, something else that I don't
know
if it'll be wonderful, but yeah.
Stadium Wars, Act a Million. So we've been talking about this forever, right?
Yeah.
The Sixers want to move to Market East, Center City. The Flyers, which own the Wells Fargo Center, are not happy about that. They're against it. They have made a counterproposal to completely revamp the South Philadelphia Stadium complex, which, I got to be honest, does seem like a pretty good idea. It could use some revamping. It's basically just a big parking lot that no one uses 98% of the time. So the development is that Comcast Spectacor, which made this proposal, which owns the Flyers, now has a new partner, the Philadelphia Phillies, who happen to play down there in the same stadium complex. So the Phillies say, we're going to be a partner in this. We're going to provide some funding. We're going to help get this thing across the finish line. This is a massive proposal, $2.5 billion proposal.
A lot of billions.
A lot of billions today. They're going to add a, you know, music venue, and they're going to add shops and restaurants and apartments. I mean, it's very ambitious, a 10-year plan. So the Phillies are on board. They're going to help. No word yet from the Eagles about where they stand in all of this. Of course, we're all watching to see what they're going to do. And so this is just another little mini development in the ongoing tug of war over exactly what's going to happen in South Philadelphia.
And I have to note that Comcast Spectacor CEO Daniel Hilferty has said, of course, he will welcome back the 76ers to the sports complex. So to me, it's like this is a big carrot. Will you come back and be with us in South Philly?
Yeah, the answer
change
is
your
no,
mind.
But yeah.
Change your mind, please. Come be with the Phillies. Be with the Flyers. Join forces with us.
I will
say this
to Comcast Spectacor. They owned the Sixers for multiple decades. They could have gotten all of this done back then. They are now being forced to act because of the Sixers' pressure. It would shock me if at this late hour they turn back around. But you never know. Maybe if they get rejected in Market East, they will, and you know, tuck tail and turn back to South Philadelphia. But, you know, I don't think it's a great relationship right now. From the outside, that's what I observe.
So we're going to move on now to our newsmaker. And here in front of me, I'm looking at Avi sip on
it's delicious.
This wonderful can. It is, and you can't see it, but I'm going to describe it. It's tall. It has somewhat creepy, cool skull design with the words liquid death in Gothic lettering. You've probably seen these liquid death cans in stores and ads, and maybe you drink it like I do. And while it looks like these cans hold beer, which I originally thought, or some kind of energy drink, it is simply water. Their tagline, murder your thirst.
This water company, which has taken the water world by storm, was started by Delaware native Mike Cesario. It was just recently valued at $1.4 billion, and Mike joins us now to talk about the company's unlikely origin story and how he made canned water cool. Mike, welcome to Studio 2.
Hey, guys. How you doing? Thanks for having me on.
We are so happy to have you on. We love this story.
We do. We
have so many questions about it. I do, though, first want to establish your Delaware Valley bona fides.
And so, your street cred. Your street cred. Right here.
So so am I reading this right? You're born in Delaware, grew up in Chester County. Is that right?
Yeah, I went to school through sixth grade in Wilmington, Delaware. I went to Warner Elementary, and I remember recently be canceled because there would be like shootings and things. It was pretty crazy to go to elementary school in the middle of Wilmington. But then ultimately went to Pennsylvania in southern Chester County for middle school and high school.
And you were kind of in the punk rock scene. You were a musician. What were you up to as a kid?
Yeah, I grew up skateboarding from a really young age, like I think 6 or 7 years old. And then, eighth grade was playing guitar and started playing in bands. And then, played in a band through high school. I was always sort of the guy in the band that was silk screening the t-shirts and doing the show flyers. So I kind of always had that creative sort of design DIY background. And then, ultimately had a career in advertising and then started Liquid Death.
And so you took Liquid Death from an idea that few believed in to like this billion-dollar brand now. Where did you come up with the idea that water, marketed well, and I got to give you kudos because it's very well marketed. When did you come up with the idea that this could be a game changer?
Yeah, it was funny in the very beginning. People were like, oh, water in a can. That doesn't make any sense. You know, how is water in a can valuable? But it's like, did you know Aquafina, which is purified tap water in a plastic bottle, does over $1 billion in sales a year, which means it would probably be worth five times that as a valuation? Or Dasani, purified tap water in a plastic bottle does over $1 billion a year. Fiji does several hundred million a year. So, the bottled water category is a huge category that people spend a lot of money on. So I think that was the reason why, we were able, we had investors and folks excited early on because it really is a massive, bottled water is a huge category. A lot of people are buying it. And then the fact that we were offering something that was one, differentiated from a brand standpoint, there's no other water brand that's like Liquid Death. And because we're in an infinitely recyclable aluminum can, our whole death to plastic mission, I think resonates with folks who everyone kind of knows that plastic bottles are a big problem.
So you guys launched an ad campaign, or at least an ad, before you even had a product to put out there on the market. I'm going to play the very beginning of this ad, which went viral. Do we have that clip? Can we roll that?
I'm a professional actor, and I'm getting paid to tell you about a revolutionary new product.
Liquid Death Mountain Water.
So dripping in irony,
I love it.
From the beginning, the idea, the name Liquid Death, how did you land on that? When did it come to you?
So, with my advertising background, working on all different kinds of campaigns and marketing for brands, typically what happens with a brand is you create a product and a product name that's, it's okay. It's not super interesting, it's okay. And you've got this product that's just okay, the can, the name, the package, whatever. Then down the road, you go and pay a lot of money to a big advertising agency to create a campaign around your product that's really interesting, that gives people a reason to care about your product or make your product relevant. When you're a new startup company, you will not have real money for marketing for a long time. So you kind of have to bake all the marketing into the actual product itself.
Right? Mm.
So when we know, hey, if we can't build a big expensive campaign around this thing, how is the product itself, when you see it on the shelf, you have to pick it up. You're like, what is that? And when you pick it up, is it so interesting that you're going to take a photo of it, post it on your social media to your hundreds of followers for us for free to tell other people about it? Or are you going to buy it and then you have to go tell somebody about it later? Oh my God, have you heard of this liquid death stuff? No way. What is that? Is that beer? No, it's water. Get out of here. Like, it actually creates a conversation. There's very, very few products that just from the packaging alone are able to do that. So when
how
we
did you know, though, Mike, that it wasn't just going to confuse people? Like, when someone proposed, I don't know if it was you or someone else in the startup said, let's call it liquid death. What was the conversation around whether this would entertain versus confuse?
What most people don't understand in marketing is confusion can actually be really powerful. Because something that isn't clear immediately makes you stop and think, and it even creates a conversation. Even as you guys know, probably in media, it's best, like on a radio talk show, that you have two opposing viewpoints versus two people who just agree totally and talk about whatever it is. It's like you always want something that has opposing viewpoints to create conversation. Wait, liquid death, why is it called that? Should it be called that? Is that good? Is it bad? Mm. Well, it's water, but hey, it's, you know. So creating conversation is valuable. So if you just create, like, for instance, when I tell people, oh, what do you do? I run this beverage company called Liquid Death. Sometimes they'll be like, oh yeah, what's that? Some like new IPA or energy drink? I'm like, no, it's water. Water? What do you mean water? Like, if you are what people expect, there's no reason to pay attention any longer. It's like, oh, it's that? Okay, I think I already know what this is. I don't need to spend any more time. But the minute you get people to lean in because it doesn't totally make sense to them at first, like, you're in a way more valuable position.
And I have to tell you, Mike, my guy brought me some Liquid Death and I'm like, why are you giving me this energy drink? And he's like, it's just water. And I got the mango sparkling and it was delicious, by the way. And so I got to ask you this, but this sort of your product sort of coincides with what I call this sober and sober curious sort of lifestyle that a lot of people are leaning into. And they don't. There's trends and studies showing that people drink alcohol less, but they want to still go to concerts, go to the club, go to bars and feel cool. And it's like Liquid Death allows you to do that. Did you know that this was the trend, or did you just sort of happen to have right time, right place for Liquid Death to come out?
Yeah, it was all kind of part of the vision, which was, look, all the data is there that 95% of the decisions we all make are emotional decisions, not rational. Mm-hmm. Like, whether we realize it or not, every decision we make, the clothes we wear, the beverages we buy, there's not a rational reason that someone's buying a $30 t-shirt when you can literally go buy any t-shirt anywhere for probably a couple bucks somewhere. So functionally it serves the same purpose, but there's a reason someone's willing to spend more on something because it's helping communicate something about themselves, whether you call that cool or whatever you want to call that. There's a reason people are buying things, especially things that you have in public around other people. Your toothpaste, maybe people don't care so much because no one's really seeing your toothpaste tube at your house and no one really sees you when you're brushing your teeth. But if you're holding a can at work or at a party or at a bar or walking around, it matters to people what brand it is. And that's just reality. Even though it doesn't make logical sense, it's the same, you know, one water versus another water. You could buy a cheaper water in a plastic bottle and it's the same thing you're drinking. But there's a reason people make choices like that.
So if I was an investor or a potential investor, and there's many reasons why I'm not, I don't have any money, Mike. But the main question that I would have for you is, how do you maintain this idea over time? Because what it seems to me from the outside is that you've created almost this amazing joke that has many different permutations, but at the end of the day, people get tired of that idea or that joke, or the novelty wears off, and then you still need something to fall back on. You've mentioned Saturday Night Live as a model for your brand. Explain that to me. How do you get longevity out of something that starts with such high novelty value?
Well, novelty is an interesting word. What it can mean a bunch of different things. I mean, if by novelty, it means Liquid Death makes marketing that makes people laugh. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what it is at the end of the day. I mean, all of our Monster and Red Bull, they have a great They've proven out, if you can blur the lines between being an entertainment company and a beverage company so that you never really make traditional marketing, you make entertainment in service of your brand, that is going to build way more brand loyalty. Monster right now, if you look them up, they're a publicly traded company valued at $62 billion. It's the highest performing stock of the S&P over Apple, Amazon, everything of the last 30 years. When Monster launched with skateboarders and snowboarders, everyone said the same thing. Oh yeah, this It'll is some off. Like
yeah.
extreme sports novelty. It's never gonna last. So, but I think the bigger thing is when they were creating entertainment instead of marketing, that kept people loyal. And I think that's our, with comedy, I think comedy is an even bigger genre than action sports is. And SNL has been a show for 40 years because with comedy is so much about making fun of whatever's happening in culture at the moment.
So you're a comedy company.
Yeah, that's all we do.
It's a comedy company in a sense.
Exactly.
And I got to ask you, because you are an expert marketer, you know, and we only have a couple minutes left. Yeah. But if you were to give marketing advice, right, to a brand or product, say like Studio 2, we're about to turn 1 year old, what would be a general rule that you would use for getting folks to take notice? Because you've been able to do this for, I guess, 20 years at this point.
Yeah, I think the best advice I can give, the best way to market is to not make it feel like marketing, which means talk to people the way that you personally would talk to people. Like if you were trying to get someone to listen to your radio station, you wouldn't say to your friend, "Hi, our station has this much coverage." No, you'd be like, "Hey, you know, we do this, we do that. Like, it's pretty cool. Like, you should check it out." Like, people like to be talked to in a way that doesn't feel like a corporation. They want people, they trust people more when companies talk to them more the way they actually talk to friends. That's a reason that Donald Trump had as much success as he has. Like when all politicians have this very corporate safe speak and one guy is saying this, that, people are like, "Oh wow, that's how my friends talk. He doesn't sound like a politician. I might trust him." So marketing is kind of the same way. It's like, don't talk to people like a corporation. Talk to them the way you would talk to them personally, one-on-one, even if you're making this huge campaign.
All right, Mike. Well, you're worth $1.4 billion, or the company is. We might tap into that for the FCC fine. Just letting you know about that. Mike Cesario, founder, CEO of the Liquid Death Water brand. And Jamie, by the way, one of our listeners, just wants to thank you for inventing this remarkable canned beverage. Came across the drink 3 years ago before retirement from the Marine Corps and have been a devoted consumer ever since. So that's from Jamie. A thank you to you, Mike. And thank you for coming on our program, Studio 2.
I like the sparkly water. There you go. And coming up.
Thank you, guys.
Yes. And coming up, we're going to be talking about littering in Philadelphia, its effects on the community, and what we can do to make the city cleaner, greener, and safer. Lots of comments already. Stick with us. We want to hear from you. We'll be right back.
Welcome back, everybody, to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolf-Manarin.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. So, Avi, how clean is your neighborhood?
I think it's pretty clean, actually. I don't know. People complain about South Philadelphia all the time. I don't know. It's what I kind of expect living in a dense neighborhood. But I understand that that's not everyone's experience in Philadelphia. You do see people littering every day. Mm-hmm. Drivers, you know, roll down the car window, toss the Wawa cup, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, I've seen that as well. And it seems like littering has become part of our culture. And some headlines refer to our beautiful city. And by the way, I love Philly. Been here 15 years. They call us Philadelphia. And many are saying enough already. Mayor Sherelle Parker in her recent budget address had these words to say.
If public safety is priority number one for Philadelphians, guess what? Quality of life issues is number 1A. When residents see overflowing trash cans, short dumping sites that pile back up only days after being cleared, cars forgotten and abandoned, then it's easy for you to understand why some folks don't believe that their neighborhoods will ever be clean and green again. We're not getting the basics right, Philadelphia. The Parker administration and this one Philly budget right now says no more excuses. We are going to make Philadelphia the cleanest and the greenest big city in America.
So let's talk about a cleaner, greener, safer Philadelphia. With us today are Carlton Williams, director of the Office of Clean and Green Initiatives. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
We also have your fave Trashman, a.k.a. Terrell Hegler. He is a former sanitation worker who has become a community activist on this issue. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, guys.
We also have John McDonald, professor of criminology and sociology at the University of Pennsylvania. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And, of course, also joining us today could be you, our listener. Send us your questions, your comments about this cleanup effort. Do we have a culture of litter here in the city? Our number is 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org.
Let's start with a comment, actually, from Lynette, who says, "It makes me so sad when I come back home. I used to fuss at kids on my block when I saw them throw stuff on the ground. I knew it was bad when I was there. But now that I moved, it looks so much worse when I come back." That's Lynette's perspective. Carlton Williams, how did we get here? Give us some history, because you can go back and find Philly winning like awards in the 40s and 50s for cleanliness. What led us to this point?
Well, I think a lot of things happened. Number one, poverty in neighborhoods where neighborhood agencies and properties decayed to a point. Many people moved out. Property values went down. And unfortunately, litter became commonplace, things like illegal dumping. And if you look in our poverty-stricken neighborhoods throughout the city of Philadelphia, those have the highest indices of dumping. And that's because there's access to vacant land that's dark, desolate, and there's some easy access points where people ultimately find an easy way to dump there. We also try to support our residents in underserved communities, but they can't do it alone. And unfortunately, people take advantage of those opportunities to dump there who don't live here. But there's also problems commonplace within our neighborhoods. I think the young lady who asked that question, there's a sense of apathy that it's okay to throw litter on the streets. And that's the culture and behavior that we have to change. That's the Philadelphia language that we have to remove, that the mayor desperately wants us to fix, and she despises that she wants us to address these issues. But I think it's a combination of a lot of things. First, we have to teach people the importance of a clean environment. That starts at a young age. You know, little litter bugs turn out to be big litter bugs. So you need to change that type of culture and behavior by going into the schools first. And that's one of the things that our administration wants to do. We want to establish litter-free school zones throughout the city of Philadelphia, make it a part of the educational curriculum to take care of your school around in the areas in which you live. And ultimately, those habits become things that you take home and be able to break ultimately. We also have to do enforcement. We have to address people who don't take care of their properties or who come into our city and leave it like a treat it like a trash can. People that come in and dump think that the cost of dumping is worth the risk to be able to come in and get away with it if they get caught. And so we're changing those rules. Mayor Parker, when she was council member Parker, ultimately created legislation that would allow us to increase those fines, but we need the people to do it, and that's what this budget represents.
But you said the first domino there was blight.
Yes.
But were there things that the city government used to do to counteract this problem that it stopped doing at
like
some point along the way?
Yeah.
Well, we had to discontinue street sweeping back in the early 2000s because of budgetary constraints. Yep. So when you're forced with the type of recession that we were faced with, you have to make a choice.
Track back to blight and disinvestment in other ways.
Absolutely.
For sure.
But when you're making a choice between whether I pick up the trash every week or whether I sweep the streets because I have to cut your budget, you have to take the option of what's the priority. And the priority was making sure that we provided the basic service of collecting trash. Sure. We are happy that we reinstituted that and we're expanding it, especially in neighborhoods that have high indices of litter.
And so I want to bring you your fave trash man into the conversation because Mr. Carlton Williams over here talked about trash collection and all those things. You've started out working in sanitation here in the city, became very popular on social media. What was it like? What did you see as a challenge, as some of the challenges that made, that transformed you into an activist?
For me, it was kind of like education. Like, people didn't understand the difference between what was recyclable, what wasn't. So that aided in to the fact that as a sanitation worker, I'm on a recycle truck, but you have styrofoam all in your recycle, so now I can't take it.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
And that's where the frustration came. So that's kind of how I started the brand off, was like, well, to make my job easier, because I want to work smarter, not harder, and to relieve some of the frustration. And again, I was a sanitation worker during the pandemic, so frustration and anxiety was already high. So for me, it was making sure that people understood those basic services that they were getting, but then also understood that here's a breakdown of things that I didn't know as a kid. Like, I was talking to Carlton earlier, I traveled to Austin, Texas, and their sanitation department sends homes letters every week. Here's this, here's that, this is a new program, this is what recyclable, that start comp, they got their whole city to compost just by selling mailers home.
And so it was sort of like, help me, help you. And what did you see as far as like, because people put their trash out once a week. A lot of times you see trash literally blowing down the street. What did you see that was a challenge that you felt like contributed to this overall litter being,
well,
and trash
really was
being visible?
The pandemic. Yeah. I mean, when everybody was home, statistics say there was almost 40% more trash on the ground. And Carlton will back me up. On the truck, where 40 houses would fill a truck, we were filling the truck in 20.
Wow.
And it's like, well, okay, now we got to taking more trips to the dump. And so now houses are being left off the route. So then you have the unhoused going through bags. You have animals. You have the weather. You have all those things contributing. So, yeah, I usually do get to this house by 3 p.m. It's 12 o'clock, and I'm still on the first or second block.
It was just the volume of trash that you had to deal with. Yeah.
Let me ask you, because you have this street-level view, and you've now looked at what other cities do. What do you consider sort of like the low-hanging fruit, something that Philly could do right now that would have a big impact on this problem?
Oh, you're about to have a lot of people hate me on this one.
I ask that because I agree that there are these big structural problems, blight and disinvestment and poverty, and we want to address all of that. But right now, today, that low-hanging fruit, something we could start with.
Okay, I'll give you two.
Okay.
One, we could add the metal trash cans. If we could find somebody to give us 1,000 metal trash cans and just put them on every single corner and these underserved
basic wire metal
trash cans with a bag, with a game plan to change them out consistently. You heard Sherelle Parker talk about overflowing trash cans. Yeah. Let's not let them overflow.
Basic, so you think that would be a big impact right away?
Big impact, because I was at 22nd and Diamond, and I walked from one trash can to the next, 700 feet apart. Mm. Who's holding a potato chip bag for 700 feet?
Right.
You're going to throw it on the ground.
More
saturate with trash cans. You said you had a second.
Okay.
This is the controversial one?
This is the controversial one. I want to say that I love DC 33 a whole lot, but
this is the union.
Yeah. Yes. Philadelphia is probably the last big city that still manually throws trash. Every other big city has added the arms to the back of the trash cans, right?
Yep.
Now, and Philly's very dense, so we would have to add standardized trash cans, but I think there's a way where we could do it. Where
speed things up.
We could, and we wouldn't get rid of jobs. We would just improve efficiency. So instead of having one truck do 40 houses, we have two trucks do 20.
Two very interesting ideas.
And I want to bring you in, John McDonald, who is a professor of criminology and sociology at the University of Pennsylvania, because we're talking about trash, we're talking about cleanup, we're talking about blight, but it has a direct impact on crime. Explain some of the research that you've been part of. Well,
we've been doing work here in Philadelphia for over 10 years now, and there's pretty clear evidence that if you look at a block where there's more litter, so if you look at the old Philadelphia Litter Index that used to be collected, for example, you'll find there's higher rates of gun violence than even blocks that are just a few blocks away. So it's not just poverty. It's also with the social dynamics that change on a block. When people are throwing litter, it's accumulated. There's the blight. There's a short dumping. you know, those things kind of create a sense, I think, that, you know, that a place isn't being cared for. And as a result, you tend to see crime increase on those blocks relative to blocks that are right next door, you know, similarly poor, but don't have those same kind of dynamics.
So it's not just correlation. There's cause and effect perhaps at play here.
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, there's we're, you know, to follow on, you know, the suggestion, what could you do immediately? I mean, one thing that could be done immediately, and we're studying this right now, is you could institute targeted street cleaning from community groups on the blocks that are the hardest hit by litter. So this wouldn't be in place of sanitation, but would be an addition, you know, and
augment. Yeah.
Yeah. Augment. It's about $150 a block to have that work done.
And by the way, and for folks who want to participate, if you have questions, comments, you can call 888-477-9499. We're going to have to go to break in about a minute or so, but I got to ask a follow-up question. What is it psychologically, and I think Carlton Williams touched on this a little bit, that makes people feel like they can participate in crime, or crime is more likely to happen when there's trash and litter?
Well, if you think about it, if an area is kind of disordered, right, there's litter, there's a sense that no one's taking care of the place. It just tends to attract people who might have criminal inclinations, you know, that versus you're on a block where people are kind of taking care of the place. They're looking out for each other, spending time there, socializing. What happens when a block gets abandoned effectively is, you know, the people that are more likely to be involved in crime, and they're a very small fraction of the population. They tend to cluster in those locations.
I want to bring in, sorry, just two comments before our break and then go to break. I want to talk about this on the other side, Carlton Williams. Nick says, contractor dumping is off the charts. Mm-hmm. Catch them and give them jail time. Chris says, I've seen pickup trucks loaded with trash headed into the city. It's coming from outside. So when we come back, Carlton Williams, I'll let you mull that for a bit. I want to talk about the big dumpers, not just the folks throwing the potato chip bag on the ground, what we can do about that. And, of course, give you a chance to respond to some of these ideas. So we have a lot more coming. On Studio 2 this hour, talking all about trash. Our guests are Carlton Williams, John McDonald, and your fave trash man, Terrell Hegler. We'll be
Email
right
us.
Back.
Email us, studio2@whyy.org. Thank you.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolf-Manera.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. We continue our conversation about the problem of littering with our guests. And let me reintroduce them. Carlton Williams, Director of the Office of Clean and Green Initiatives, your fave trash man. We also have John McDonald, Professor of Criminology and Sociology at the University of Pennsylvania. Everybody, welcome back to Studio 2.
All right. So I teed that one up for you, Carlton Williams. Yep. Let's talk about the folks who are dumping a lot of trash in our city habitually. What do we know about these folks? How can we stop them?
Sure. The majority of people that we're seeing as doing this type of behavior are probably your small contractors with C and D, construction and demolition material, where they're doing house cleanouts. Someone may have asked to clean out a house before they move to another residence, and then they not only take it from that resident, they drop it around the corner for the city to collect. And we see a lot of that type of behavior going on throughout the city. And how we combat that is through surveillance cameras. We use the same cameras that our police network that uses to catch criminals. We do the same thing with illegal dumpers. And we try to strategically place them in locations that we've gotten frequent calls about. They look for hot spots like in places like Eastwick and down in North Philadelphia in industrial areas where, you know, they have businesses that are desolate right now. Again, we talk about vacant areas and vacant places where they find places. The Logan Triangle on Roosevelt Boulevard is a constant location. So we're putting cameras up in those locations to monitor and catch dumpers. The key is that you have to have a back-end solution, meaning that the enforcement has to be strong enough and swift enough to deter the type of behavior. So we're working with the district attorney's office. We're working with the police department. But we've come up with a new process that's working. It's called civil restitution, where we actually sue the person. And they not only pay heftier fines, but they pay the cost of the cleanup for the city of Philadelphia. A year ago, we caught our first. This person was actually advertising a cleanout company, taking the debris from the person's home and driving it two blocks away and dumping it in an abandoned location where the city would have to often clean it up. And ultimately, we worked with the DA's office. We worked with the inspector general's office. We did our research to catch him. And he got a $10,000 fine, and he paid $2,500 for the cost of cleanup. That's the teeth that we need to stop people and deter it. But we also need to advertise and let people know that these things exist as well.
And by the way, I want to bring in a few comments. Isabel says parks have very limited trash bins full of dog poop bags that don't get cleaned regularly and end up elsewhere. Christopher says, I don't even know where to start. From the 1970s on, littering has become one of Philly's biggest downfalls. What can one do? I got to ask, and Avi and I were talking about this off mic, like, what is the city's responsibility versus individual responsibility? Where is the line? Because it seems like there are things that individuals can do, but then there's a lot that the city has to do.
So I'll start with the city, and then we can briefly talk about some of the things that your fave trash man and John talked about earlier. With individuals, what they can do. The city collectively has to address these areas in underserved communities. And this strategy not only deals with the streets department, it has to be license and inspection. We have abandoned autos that flourish throughout the city of Philadelphia. All of these quality of life issues need to be addressed holistically. Multiple agencies need to focus on those and then once make an established connection with the community so that we can sustain what we've cleaned up. We've cleaned up many of these sites thousands of times, but unfortunately the fine dumping that occurs again. So we need to put in prevention methods. We talked about cameras. We talked about making investments in additional trash cans, but we also need to make sure that we're focusing on areas that are hit the hardest, and that's some of the strategies that the city of Philadelphia is doing. Individually, if everyone took the opportunity to just clean up in front of their homes and put out their trash collection, we would eliminate most of our litter problems when you see loose litter out in the streets today.
And your favorite trash man, I've got to ask you. I mean, Jocelyn says, I remember there used to be so many street cleanup events, bring it back. Your thoughts on individual responsibility?
I mean, that's kind of my thing is kind of like what John said, not going against, but a yes and. Like, yes, the city is doing these things, and I'm going to add more. So, you know, since 2021, I've organized over 150 cleanups in every part of the city. And the main thing I tell people is 6 feet both directions, 6 feet in front of your house, 6 feet to the left, 6 feet to the right. If you take care of that and everybody's on the same accord. So the mayor's talking about this one Philly. You know, I say let's all say yes to a cleaner Philadelphia, because if you have a block of 10 and only six neighbors are cleaning, what are we doing? It doesn't help. Everyone has to make the conscious decision to say, yes, I'm not going to litter. Yes, I'm going to properly put my trash out. Yes, I'm going to do this. Yes, I'm going to recycle right. If you have 10 out of 11, we're still losing. And I think that's where the issue lies.
I want to read in some suggestions from some of our listeners. Marsha mentions curbside trash cans, Saturday cleanup days, bi-weekly required meetings, prize stipend giveaways to the best kept steps. That's kind of a cool idea.
That is.
Debbie says each merchant that sells disposable items should be required to maintain a trash can outside their establishment. Interesting. Maybe putting the onus on business. Deborah just says people need to be held accountable for their environment. So on accountability, John McDonald, you're a criminologist. We talked about more teeth, more enforcement. Would that work in this space? How does it compare to, say, you know, stiffer criminal penalties for other types of behavior?
I mean, I think the key, if in the specific case of illegal dumping that's being done by commercial enterprises, you can make a strong case for certainty of punishment more than the severity. So if people think they're going to pay a cost. But I think on a citywide level, you know, you're not going to enforce your way into a clean city, you know, in terms of individuals dropping trash. if you look around the world, I mean, one of the things that you see is places like Copenhagen, you know, they clean, they have street cleaning sometimes a couple times a day, you know. I think it's easier to drop litter when their litter's already there. Right. And so I think part of it is
litter is a magnet for more.
Yeah. So if you can get the street cleanups to happen, it's easier then to sustain and change the behavior, because then people feel like it's unusual to drop a bag of chips when the block's clean.
Can I say something?
Yeah.
To John's effect, one of my biggest issues is getting the stakeholders on board. So when I started my nonprofit, I started applying for grants. Every single foundation was like, we don't sponsor cleanups because that's what the city does. But now we're talking about multiple street cleanups. Imagine if Comcast took $10 million and had a program to pay 10 nonprofits to do daily street cleanups. Imagine the investment that does for our city. So I just want to bring in the fact that when they say yes to everyone, we're talking about the big corporations, we're talking about city government, we're talking about residential. I think it's a three-part triangle. You need government, corporations, and residentials all to come on the accord and say, this is what we want. And then you have people
row in the same direction. Everybody.
Exactly. Exactly.
And that sort of answers David's question, which is, what will it take to clean up the city? And I asked people, I said, do you think Philly has this litter culture, right? People have said littering is part of Philly's culture. Changing it starts in schools and families through education. Making trash disposal easier and more convenient is also important. People talk about starting programs in schools so that the young people can teach the parents. What is it going to take? Because we have to shift it. I mean, everybody's saying here that when you have trash, you put, I've seen people throw Pampers out of their window. Yeah. Mm. You know, how do you sort of change that culture and get a hold and get everybody rowing in the same direction, Carlton Williams?
So I heard the residents, the callers with the questions starting with the schools. I think I started off with
that's
important to start to educate. You know, there's four pillars. There's education, there's community outreach. You talked about getting neighbors involved, programs like Block Captains who constantly keep their neighborhoods. They tell me all the time, you know, I'm the only one out here cleaning. No one else cares. And so we have to start changing the culture and the mindset of people to start loving Philadelphia again and to get them involved in doing more activities so they can appreciate our city. We talked about enforcement, and we also talked about cleaning and greening. Until we get to a point where we do have a clean city, we have to make these type of investments. I think one of your callers also talked about how we collect trash. That's absolutely correct. How they set out trash, you know. Your fave can deal with it, can talk about this more than I can. You know, there's things out there that people wouldn't even touch, how they set it out. And our trash guys are constantly dealing with that each and every day. That is a challenge. We need to change that culture on how people set out trash and so forth. And the last thing that I'll say is, and I'll put a plug in, you know, we have the annual Philly Spring Cleanup. That's April 6th this year.
It's coming out.
PhillySpringCleanup.com. Make sure we give bags, brooms, gloves. We give all of those things. That's a true partnership program. Program that continues to work.
We only have a minute left, but I did want to sort of redirect something Yafave said earlier back to you, Carlton Williams, which is some of that low-hanging fruit, some of the stuff we can get started on right away. More trash cans, arms on the trash trucks so that we can mechanize some of this process. Are those realistic proposals?
So more trash cans is definitely, and they're on the way. The mayor wants to double the amount of trash cans that we have currently in the city of Philadelphia. That's in this year's budget. So that is actually going to happen. The arm, the semi-automated collection process that Yafave talked about earlier, we've actually piloted that in certain areas of the city. In densely populated communities, it is a challenge because of now no off-street parking.
You said it could be done, your fam. You think it could be done?
I think there's a Philly way to do it.
Okay.
And I think, because I know what block you're talking about on Temple, where you did the can program with the 24-ounce green cans. And so I know exactly what you're talking about, and I studied it. And then I talked to Austin, Texas, and they had some ideas on how we could alternate it
so
for
maybe,
Philly.
So maybe, Carlton.
Oh, yeah.
We certainly will. We're open to any and every suggestion that will help us get to a safer, cleaner, greener Philadelphia.
Real quick.
Yeah, I think you could have a summer jobs program for youth. Through
put
different
them to work.
Community
I
groups.
I did that last summer.
And the highest, you know, the worst affected neighbors or trash, and they could get paid youth a living wage to do that.
We do have to end it there. There's so much more to say, I know. But Carlton Williams, Director of the Office of Clean and Green Initiatives, your fave trash man, John McDonald from Penn, thank all of you
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
And that wraps up our show. Thank you to Debbie Builder and Andreas Copes, who produced today's program. Charlie Kyer engineered the show today. Joan Isabella is WHYY's audio general manager from Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia. I am Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolf-Manero. Go Drexel, go Princeton, and the women's basketball tournament coming up on Friday. We'll see you next week.